A really neat book is out now from Harbor Publishing, The Best of Jim Coleman, 50 Years of Canadian Sport from the Man Who Saw It All. Jim Coleman, of course, is a legendary Canadian sports columnist who saw it all, from the Victoria Cougars winning the Stanley Cup in 1925 to Canada beating the Russians in 1972, from Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth at training camp to Jackie Robinson in the minor leagues in Montreal, and of course a few racehorses along the way. Coleman died in 2001 at the age of 89, but he's resurrected, as it were, in this new collection of his finest columns. Culled together by his old friend, the equally esteemed Jim Taylor, The Best of Jim Coleman is a fascinating and remarkable look back at not only sporting history, but also Canada, through the matchless writing of one of the best this country has ever seen. The Best of Jim Coleman, 50 Years of Canadian Sport from the Man Who Saw It All, edited by Jim Taylor from Harbor Publishing, is $34.95. I am pleased to welcome to thecommentary.ca Jim Taylor. Good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Good morning.
Do you keep all of your old columns?
Oh, yes. In fact, I went even further. I was kidding my wife the other day. I said, well, nobody's going to have to go grubbing for mine because, A, I saved them all, and, B, I've already published two collections.
Now, I'll ask you about how you found all of these old Jim Coleman columns. Easily you could have gone to the microfiche at these newspapers and searched for all of this stuff, but there's an interesting story about how you came across these boxes of old Jim Coleman columns. How did you find all of the columns?
A year after Jim died, his widow Maggie phoned me and said, I'm changing apartments, will you help me go through Jimmy's stuff? So I said, okay, and I went over there, and I took 2 days and got all the books sorted and all the things and the pictures given away and everything, and this shows you how close it can be. I actually had my hand on the doorknob, and I said, well, Meg, that's it, we're done. And she said, well, there is that old filing cabinet in the basement. We went downstairs into the basement. We had to break into the storage locker. Then we had to break into the old filing cabinet, and the top drawers were kind of interesting because they had expense accounts from 1940, and, you know, right. Hotel, $7. But in the bottom two drawers, I found 14 of those long cardboard florist flower boxes, you know,
right,
containing an actual newspaper copy of every column Jim had ever written from 1939 to 1986. There may be a few missing, but not very many. And I looked at it, and I thought, oh, my God.
It must have been, I don't know, if you're a fan of him, a fan of good writing, it must have been just, you hit pay dirt when you saw that, right?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, I was quite naive. I thought, well, there's a book there. There has to be a book there. And I thought there would be publishers just tripping over themselves trying to get it. But what I did is I read them all. I picked about the top 125 or so. I made copies of those so that I wouldn't harm the originals. And then I took them all to Costa Rica with my scanner and my printer and my computer, and I scanned them all into the computer while I was on holidays and edited them all and came back blithely expecting to see publishers saying, oh, yeah. Well, first of all, the Canada Council said no. Then about every publisher I talked to said no, and including one of them who said to me, but he's dead. And I said, well, yeah, you're going to notice that with a lot of your good writers, like Shakespeare's gone, and Hemingway, he's gone, and, you know, Keats and Byron, all those guys, they're not producing much lately, but they're still selling. And, of course, that ended. So I was at my wit's end. I didn't think we were going to get it published. I really didn't. And then a Canadian press writer named Jimmy Morris wrote a piece about the Coleman columns. For some strange reason, the Vancouver Sun picked it up, although Coleman had written for the province. It ran in the Sun, and I got a phone call from two guys who were business partners, Jerry Strongman and Peter Keynes, and Peter's father had shared a rooming house with Coleman in the late 1930s in Brandon, Mrs. Minion's boarding house, and his partner, Jerry Strongman, had gone to school, high school and college, with Jim's son. And they just said to me, do it. And I said, well, it's going to cost a fair chunk of money. And they said, do it. So we did.
And here it is today. What's the reaction been to the book?
Well, it's hard to tell because the reaction has been super. But so far, you know, the book's only been in the store. store for about a week or so, and when you get the reaction, of course, you're getting it from media people who knew Jim, and so you're more or less preaching to the choir. We will find out next week when I start going on the Cross Canada book tour and we start really hitting it. I'm hoping, I mean, I know John Grisham isn't trembling in terms of sales, but that I wanted to sell, but that wasn't really the objective. What I want, I want it in journalism schools, I want it in libraries, I want it in high schools. I want kids and adults to be able to look back and see how it was in sport and how it was in the coverage of it, because I believe that as a country we lack pride. We shove away and we forget our old stories, and the stories get lost. I mean, this is a man who was in 5 newspaper halls of fame, has the Order of Canada, and was Canada's first syndicated sports columnist. If that happened in the United States, how fast do you think I'd get a publisher?
Right.
And I got no one. Because, you know, as I always said, the next collection of columns I do is going to be tear out page one, a Canuck just farted.
I'm of the generation that doesn't know what carriage return means. Would you?
Yeah, we were Coleman and I were sitting in the province in 1994 when I still worked there, and the computers had crashed, and we're sitting there and lamenting, and Coleman looks at me and he says, "Do you know, there's a generation in our business growing up that do not know the meaning of the term carriage return." And because they never used typewriters. Coleman, to the end, never used the computer. They gave him a little office, and he sat down in that little office in the sort of the basement of the Pack Press building with his old portable typewriter, and he pounded the stuff out and then brought it up, and somebody put it into the computer for him.
I'm fairly young, so I do remember those memory lane columns in the province. But talk to us about Jim Coleman's career. Where did he start? Where was he? What papers was he in? And stuff like that?
He started in Winnipeg as a correspondent working in Brandon. Moved out to, and actually started his column career in the Vancouver province in 1939. They took him off the Marine beat because they knew he liked horse racing, and as he said, they took him off just when he was developing a taste for Navy rum, and they made him a sports columnist. And he went from there to Toronto, to the Telegram and the Globe and Mail, and then joined Southam, and they syndicated it nationally. And to get some idea of the scope, Jim Coleman covered boxing matches in the early days by dictating it to a telegrapher who was sitting next to him and pounded it out in Morse code. He saw the Stanley Cup in 25, and he was with me in Moscow in 72, and he covered more Grey Cups than I could ever think of. He was in the stands when Warren Stevens threw the first forward pass touchdown pass in a Grey Cup game. He saw it all, and I could not believe that there wouldn't be interest in you know, showcasing that.
Talk to me about his impact in terms of for people like yourself who are in the business, about just how good he was in terms of the style of writing. I mean, I read the book and reading some of the columns, I was struck by the elegance of it, the use of alliteration, the verve, the energy. What did he mean to, I guess, competitors like yourself?
Well, you know, there's two phases of it. First of all, I had known Jim since the mid-1960s. I started writing a column in 1971, and I didn't know whether I could do it or whether I'd be any good, but I said to myself, well, if I staple myself to the coattail to the best there is, maybe something will rub off, and we became very good friends. But the other part is, as well as I knew him, I had no idea how good he was, because I started reading him in the mid-60s, and it wasn't that he was at the end of it, but his really creative period was the 40s and 50s, and it was brilliant stuff. And every sports writer that I've talked to now who's seen the book without being asked says the same thing. My God, did you read that stuff on horse racing in the 50s? My God, did you read the boxing stories in the 50s and the 40s? And he was so, you're right, he was so eloquent and so Coleman always, he once described himself as a man of early talent, of early promise, wasted. As if, you know, he had a drinking problem in the early days. He drank a lot and eventually became AA and was and didn't drink for years and years and years. But he referred to his talent as basically wasted because I guess he felt he didn't hone those marvelous, marvelous skills that he had in the early days.
We're talking with the author and columnist Jim Taylor. He's written 9 other books. We're talking about his latest, a collection he's edited, The Best of Jim Coleman, $34.95 from Harper Publishing. When you compare his columns to the ones that you wrote in the 70s and 80s and then the kind of sports coverage that you see now, I guess there has been a change in how sports have been covered.
Yes, I think there's. I hate to sound like a curmudgeon, but the computers have changed everything. The death of afternoon newspapers has changed everything, and I've yet to understand why, with all this high speed equipment, deadlines keep getting earlier and earlier and earlier. Until they made me take it down, I had a banner that I'd written across my computer. It said, "If we get any effing faster, we're going to be a weekly." And so you go to a hockey game now, and you might have 5 minutes after the game's over to hit the first edition. Coleman, in the old days, traveled by train. In some of those early days, the reporters made as much money and sometimes more than the athletes. So they traveled by train with them, they sat with them, they drank with them, they played cards with them, and good stories came out that might not surface for another, you know, week or so. But there was more space, there was an eloquence, and I think there was less fandom. The Todd Bertuzzi thing in the 50s would never have, he never would have evolved from a thug into a folk hero.
Really? I'm not really much of a sports fan, so I read the book for the writing, and I was also struck at the variety of columns that there were in there. There was a piece about Hume Cronin.
Yeah.
The actor Hume Cronin, who he could have been a boxer instead of an actor.
Yeah, no, wrestler, I think.
A wrestler?
Yeah, he attended McGill University with Jim. Jim, as he said, was briefly exposed to McGill, and then he says that the dean called him in and allowed him to graduate early. But he talked about Hume Cronin, the actor, and also Max Bell, the newspaper guy, was the mogul, was went to university with him. And he told all those stories, and sure, some of them were exaggerated, of course they were, because he was a storyteller. And I think that's what we've lost. I've had offers to come back and start writing again and things, but somehow the laughter's gone out of it now. It's all so damn serious.
And then you probably couldn't get away with writing a column about Duke Ellington or going out dancing with your wife, could you?
No, not now. I couldn't. I remember at the province they were very generous. They let me do anything. I remember once writing a column that started off, "No sport today. I think the Lone Ranger is going to kiss a girl." And I reviewed the comic pages. So they gave me that freedom. But if I was to go back now, when the papers are all chain-owned and everybody's sort of anal retentive, I don't think I would be allowed that freedom.
There were a couple of I call them poignant pieces. Andy Waits It Out from the Toronto Telegram, the 30th of November, 1950. This was about the Winnipeg flood, was it?
Yes. that I sort of run a test with people. I say, read this and see if you don't get misty-eyed.
And it's hard not to.
It's hard not to. That one and the burial of Big Red, Man of War, which I thought was just a dazzling piece. And some of the Johnny Needle Nose stories. I love the racetrack characters. Johnny Needle Nose and the Blowback Kid and $100 Jones and people like a Knifey and people like that. Great, great stories. And I think also, and it isn't that the talent isn't here. There's a lot of talent out there. But I think the art of storytelling has been discouraged in newspapers now, I think, with space and things. I think they want to know A, B, B, and who scored, and who's taken Sudafed before the third period, and, you know, all that stuff. The human element, I think, is sort of gone.
Father Ingham used to say that sports writers make the best writers. That's why you see them go on to do other things.
Yes.
I can think of Christy Blatchford, for example, who's just, she started out as a sports writer, I think, and she...
Yes. Paul Gallico... Ernest Hemingway was briefly a sports writer in Toronto. They fired him. They knew he'd never get anywhere. Jimmy Breslin, the New York columnist.
Yeah.
A lot of people like that.
What do you think his influence, I guess, to the greater world of journalism, Jim Coleman's?
To my generation, a lot. To the current generation, I don't think so. The business has changed so much. I mean, it's all chain papers run by guys who've never written a word in their life, and they don't have a sense, many of them, of the sport. And so as a result, they just, as I say, they want it fast, they want it now, and they don't want it long. So the people that Jimmy grew up with, learned from him and revered him. What a backbiting business the media can be. I mean, if there's 10 of us sitting at a table, we're probably sniping at the 11th guy, and when you get up, it's your turn. I have never heard one word in my life against Jim Coleman. Not one.
And he died in 2001.
Yes.
How old was he when he died?
89. And it started because he broke his ankle when he slipped getting into a cab at age 89 to go to the province to write another column. He went to the hospital, and they said to him, and I was just leaving for Mexico, I wasn't here when he died, and they said, if you do the operation, it might, be too much of your heart. And he looked at them and said, I'm 89 years old, for God's sake, you want me to spend the rest of it in a wheelchair? Do the operation. So they did it, and he passed the operation fine, and then sure enough, two nights later, his heart gave way.
You said that you traveled to, he was with you in Russia in 1972?
Yes.
What was that like to travel with Jim Coleman?
Well, it was funny, because Jim Coleman always wore the shirt and the tie and the jacket, and he was a very proper gentleman, and felt that this was the business, and he had to show himself properly. So we were told, when we went to Moscow, that the rooms would be booked. Right? And the players who thought the series was going to be easy said, there'll be jackhammers outside your room at 3 o'clock in the morning, and Serge Savard said, that's okay, we won't be in. But, so after Game 7, when Team Canada tied the series, we went up to Coleman's room, as we always did, and this man in this three-piece suit and a tie climbed up on his bed, stretched to his full height, leaned into the sprinkler from the sprinkler system and yelled, how do you like them apples, Ivan? He also, we went to a nightclub, he and I, and a Russian nightclub, and there was one of those old-fashioned stand-up microphones and four women in front of it in the puffy-shouldered outfits, and they're singing. And Coleman looks at me and he says, I recognize Patty, Maxine, and Laverne, but who's the other one? I said, Connie Boswell. He said, ah, yes.
We will, I guess that cliched line, we will never see his likes again, is apt for Jim Coleman, is it not?
It is. Time and circumstance will never allow it. But here's Capsule Jim Coleman. He would go upstairs to have lunch in Pacific Press, and all of a sudden his table would be surrounded by people, by pressmen, by admin, by circulation people, by reporters, and he never understood why, because he was just so popular. They brought him birthday cakes, and every year he would say, well, damn it anyway, it bloody well